Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Okay, the college football conversation continues at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big East Sports Show. And right now, we're going to zero in on the Alabama, the Crimson Tide, and their head coach, Nick Saban. Monty Burke with Forbes magazine has spent the better part of the last year and a half working on his new book, an engaging biography that details what has motivated and influenced one of the most successful coaches who has won 4 national titles. The title of the book is Saban, The Making of a Coach, and such a pleasure to have with us on our Progressive Insurance Celebrity Guest Line, Monty Burke. Good evening, Monty.
How are you?
It's such a pleasure to have you with us on our show and on our network. And I'd love for you to open up with what was your motivation to write this book and what did you discover?
You know, I've been fascinated. I think Nick Saban is one of the most fascinating people in sports, partially because he was kind of unknowable. What we see of him, he seems kind of like a one-dimensional person who's just football, 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 and, sometimes on the sidelines getting red-faced, yelling at his players. And I knew that there was more there. I had the opportunity to go down a couple years ago and do a Forbes cover story on him when he in his second year at Alabama, and that spurred on my interest even more. And so, what I found, I think, was that he is a multidimensional person. He's complicated. He's complex, and the reaction to him, the feelings about him from others are equally varied and complicated and complex. And I interviewed a little over 250 people for the book, so I think a pretty fairly comprehensive kind of take on Coach Saban.
Yes, Monty, over 250 interviews that reveal his defining moments, the individuals that made him the man, the coach he is today. You just used the word fascinating. What's the most fascinating thing you learned about Nick Saban?
Oh, geez. We'll start from the beginning. Where he grew up was, to me, just absolutely fascinating. He grew up in this little tiny coal mining town in the hills of West Virginia. And it's a town that is kind of, both physically and psychically kind of scarred by its coal mining past. In fact, in Nick Saban's high school is on a bluff, looks right over a river at the site of the Monongah mining disaster, which is one of the biggest industrial accidents in United States history. And Saban's father, who I knew going in was demanding, but I didn't know quite how demanding he was. Saban's father decided not to be a coal miner, so he ran a service station there, which was hard work. And he put his son to work and daughter to work and his wife to work. I mean, everyone, they worked as hard as they could to kind of stay above the poverty line. And his father is probably the biggest influence on Nick. He was ultra demanding. He demanded kind of an impossible perfection, really. And what was fascinating to me is that was sort of the seed, or one of the pillars, I guess you could say, of what's now known as Saban's process. One of Saban's childhood friends told me that he thought when Saban was younger that he was either going to go crazy or he was going to become a great success. And the reason that the latter happened is because little Nick Saban decided that he wouldn't worry about the goal. He wouldn't worry about that impossible perfection, but he would learn to love and kind of embrace the steps taken in its pursuit, which is another way kind of defining Saban's process.
Forbes magazine, Monty Burke is with us tonight at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big East Sports Show. He's the author of the new book, Saban, talking about Nick Saban, The Making of a Coach. It's going to be a bestseller, there's no doubt about it. And it is interesting. I found that very compelling when I was going through the book, the dynamic, the relationship, the influence of his father. How did Nick Saban, share with the listeners, how did he adjust with such an over-demanding father and meet these unrealistic expectations?
He just would. There's a great little anecdote about his father asking him to go clean out a drain, a storm drain. And he went down there with a couple buddies, and it was, you know, he went down there, he was down there for half an hour or whatever, and it was almost clean. And one of his buddies was like, let's go play. He said, no, I got to sit here until this thing is absolutely clean because I don't want to hear about it later. And his father was his first football coach. He coached his Pop Warner team.
Mm-hmm.
The son, Nick Saban, the son played quarterback and safety, and, you know, Nick Saban would throw a touchdown pass. They had a great team. They won, I think they won 39 games straight. Throw a touchdown pass, run to the sidelines, and instead of congratulations, his father would say, you know, that spiral wasn't very tight and your footwork was all messed up. I had another one of Nick Saban's childhood friends tell me that there wasn't one practice that Nick Saban's father didn't make his son cry. I think this had a huge influence on him, a huge influence of one of the reasons that he has been so motivated, one of the reasons that he doesn't find happiness. You know, he wasn't happy after his first national championship game. Within 5 minutes of winning the championship game, he was barking at his assistants and asking which players, you know, which players were going to go pro. And he called one of his friends and he says, why aren't I happy? And he's one of those people who, you know, the destination doesn't matter that much. It's the journey.
You know, is he proud? But I mean, he's never satisfied, but is he proud of his achievements, his accomplishments, and all the accolades?
I mean, that's a great question. I think he must be sort of proud, but I do think that he derives his happiness, from, just doing. I mean, he finds another sort of surprising thing I found was a lot of his players said, you know, the misconception about Saban is that he's not happy. And they're like, that couldn't be more wrong. He is really happy when he's coaching football, when he's watching his 15th hour of recruiting tape. So I think that what keeps him going so much is just that, you know, day-to-day, hour-to-hour, minute-to-minute focus on building a football program, on putting together a team and managing the assistant coaches and managing the players.
We are examining the many sides of Nick Saban, talking about the new book, shining the spotlight on it. And Saban, The Making of a Coach, author Monty Burke is joining us tonight at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. We don't want to get too far into the interview. Always as a courtesy for our author interviews. Tell all the listeners, reach out to them and share where they can go and get a copy of this.
It just came out this week, and it should be everywhere in your local bookstores. And, of course, it's also on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
You know, one of the things I'm fascinated about is when you follow Nick Saban, I mean, he has such charisma, such a great personality. Where does that come from?
It probably comes from his mom. His mom was sort of, you know, the life of the party growing up. She loved to play bridge, and she'd have wine parties. And, you know, it's interesting. It's kind of like two sides to the Nick Saban coin, because in public sometimes he's not very warm. You know, his legs start to bounce, and he just doesn't feel very comfortable. And that's he's naturally very shy and kind of introverted. But in smaller settings, you know, when I first met him, I was a little worried about that. You know, I was like, oh my gosh, he barks at reporters all the time, and what's this going to be like? And you know, when I met him one on one, I found him to be one of the most charismatic people I've ever interviewed. And I've been at Forbes for 15 years talking to CEOs and celebrities and whatnot, but he is easily one of the most charismatic people. Now, in retrospect, of course, now that I've thought about this, I shouldn't have been surprised, because it's that kind of charisma in smaller settings that makes him so great at luring recruits.
You know, it's one thing to identify talent and ability and to woo these recruits, but, you know, then to have that type of charisma and to be able to appeal to their hearts and their minds, especially the parents, for them to make that decision and that commitment to attend the University of Alabama.
Absolutely. I mean, so he's mastered both sides of the of recruiting. One, of course, is identifying the talent. And as one of his former assistants told me, he's got kind of the same knack that these great thoroughbred horse racing guys do. They're able to see a very young horse and say, that's going to be a winner. He can do the same thing with this talent. But, of course, the other side of the recruiting is being able to lure these people in. It's arguably more important. And he's so good at that. I mean, he shows up at these places wearing a beautiful bespoke suit. He's done his research. One assistant coach told me that he walked into a recruit's room one time and offered him a piece of gum, and it happened to be the brand that was at this kid's favorite brand of chewing gum. So it gets
that's
down to that kind of detail. And then, of course, he compliments, you might remember the scene in The Blind Side when he compliments Sean Tui's, what's her name, Leanne Tui's draperies and stuff like that. So he just kind of hits it on each level there. But he's also, as charismatic as he is, he's also very businesslike when he gets in there. You know, a lot of coaches come into the living room, they're kind of used car salesmen, like, your son's going to start the middle linebacker first year, and we're going to make him an All-American, and he's going to go, you know. Saban doesn't say that. He says, this is our plan. He lays it out. This is our plan, and this is where you fit into the plan. I would like for you to come to the University of Alabama and fit into this plan. If you don't, we'll see you down the road on the other side of the field.
Author Monty Burke is with us tonight at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big East Sports Show. We will continue talking about his new book they've just released, The Making of a Coach, highlighting Nick Saban. Much more straight ahead tonight at YSR. Hey, glad you're with us in hour number two right here at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big East Sports Show. I'm Elissa Walker-Campbell. We would love to hear from you. We are interactive. Join us at Twitter at eRadioSports. You can always email the show at Elissa@YahooSportsRadio.com. We're kicking off hour two as we continue to shine the spotlight on the new book, Saban, The Making of a Coach. We're celebrating the start of the college football season. It is rapidly approaching, so we've got Monty Burke. He is the author. He's also with Forbes magazine. And, you know, obviously with us here in the Lone Star State and in Texas, I got to ask you this. I mean, how serious, 2013, I mean, there was a lot of rumors swirling. I mean, how serious was he about leaving Alabama and heading to the University of Texas?
I mean, so that all was going down right when I was in the sort of thought stage of this book. I was working on a proposal, and I was riveted. I mean, I sit and refresh Twitter over and over again so I could see what the latest updates were. And so I knew going into this that this was a sort of a fundamental question that I had to answer, or I had to satisfy my own curiosity about this. So I interviewed a lot of Alabama power brokers, some trustees, and some boosters, and they were pretty much in the dark. They didn't really know what was going on. And then, of course, the athletic director at Alabama, Bill Battle, later admitted to a newspaper that he was scared at this point. So then I figured, okay, I got the Alabama side. Let's go over to the Texas side. And I needed to get in touch with those two guys, Tom Hicks and Wallace Hall, who were on that phone call, that infamous phone call with Jimmy Sexton, and see what their impressions were. So I interviewed both those guys, pretty in-depth interviews, and got their takes on it. And it seemed to me that had the chips fallen in the right way, that they thought they had a chance at getting him. Now, what's so interesting to me is that one of the reasons that Texas lost out on the chance of getting him was because the administration there at the time was just in such turmoil. The president of the university was under fire. The athletic director retired in the middle of the season. They still had a coach. They had Mac Brown, who is only 2 months, or he's 2 months younger than Nick Saban, I believe, or maybe 2 months older. But so, you know, who knows? But if that turmoil had been, you know, settled a little bit more, or one thing had fallen one way, he might have been the coach at Texas.
You know, you have to wonder, too. I mean, Nick Saban, I mean, he's kind of got the reputation for being unpredictable. So it's one thing to fall in love with this guy, but who knows? What is the future, you think, for him? I mean, could Saban be on the goal somewhere else, ultimately?
That is a great question, and I wish I had a crystal ball to kind of figure that out, because a lot of people want to know that question. There's still a little anxiety, I guess, about what his next move would be. My gut says that flirtation with Texas, whether it happened or not, might have been the last one. He's going to turn 64 this year on Halloween. There are some coaches who are older than he is, Steve Spurrier, Bill Snyder, but not many. So this is legacy time now. And this is time, it gets harder and harder every year to go start over somewhere else. So I would be surprised if he left the University of Alabama. Now, it could happen. One thing that he's sort of a victim of his own success, and he's been it's been that way everywhere he's been, but no place more so than Alabama, where, you know, a trip to the national college playoff and a loss in the semifinals is considered an unsuccessful season because they didn't win a national championship. So if those expectations get to the point where he just doesn't want to deal with them anymore, maybe I could see him walking away, but I don't see it happening anytime soon, although I did see earlier this week, a national commentator saying he thought that he would be on ESPN next year. So we'll see.
Author Monty Burke is joining us tonight at Yahoo Sports Radio. The Big E Sports Show has just released a definitive biography on Nick Saban. It is titled Saban, The Making of a Coach. And when you just reflect and review his illustrious career, what do you think has been the key variable to his sustained success and the winning that he has?
You know, I joked around with a bunch of people that I interviewed that I could write the world's shortest book. I could have just written, it could have been one page. Nick Saban is organized, driven, and very smart, period. That's pretty much it. So those three attributes certainly played into it. I also just think, you know, as we talked about earlier, he loves the journey and not the destination. He loves the process and not the destination. If you love that, the process goes all the time. There's no stopping to the process. So, you know, I think he feels joy when he wins a national championship, but then, you know, he's got the infamous 24-hour rule. You can only celebrate a win or mourn a loss for 24 hours, and then it's on to the next thing. So, and I think he derives a lot of happiness from that moment-to-moment grind running a college football program.
And obviously one of the keys to his success has been his wife, Terry Saban. They were married in 1971. She's a remarkable woman, and she has played a major role, especially even with her recruiting talent.
Absolutely. I mean, she is kind of like, she's the backbone. He'll say that she runs the whole show, and he's not fibbing when he says that. She helps him recruit. She's just a very vivacious and dynamic person, and to a large degree, she also kind of smooths out his rougher edges. We talked earlier about how sometimes in public it doesn't come across as being very warm. It doesn't, frankly, come across like he really wants to be there. But she is so kind of wonderfully social and sunny that she kind of smooths out any of those rough patches he has. And she's always looked out for his best interest. I mean, when he left Miami, one of the reasons he left is because she talked him into it. And she basically told him, you know what, you like college better. You like coaching college better. You like coaching those kids better than pros. And it's going to make you happier. And you should do it. And he listened.
Author Monty Burke with us tonight at YSR, the Big E Sports Show. Go out and get a copy of the book, Saban, The Making of a Coach. Congratulations, Monty. We look forward to reconvening and having you back on the show right here, the Big E Sports Show.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely. Much more straight ahead tonight in hour number two right here at YSR. You stay close. Welcome back to Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. I am Elissa Walker-Campbell, guiding you through the fastest 2 hours in radio. Be sure and connect with us at Twitter at eRadioSports. You can always email the show at Elissa@YahooSportsRadio.com. Good to have back in studio, up close and in person, Andy Pondillo with our MLB news and notes and ready for a full 2015 MLB trade deadline recap. How are you, Andy?
I'm doing great. Final 2 months of the year, so it's the best time.
That's right. The countdown's on. Were you able to kind of regroup and get re-energized after such a very busy Friday?
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch what's gone on in MLB. There's a lot of teams that strengthened. There's some teams that made me scratch my head. But in the end, we're going to find out who the strongest teams really are. The 162-game schedule, we've seen a lot of teams play good for 5 months and then fall off the map in September. We've seen teams before that played 500 ball. Then the last 2 months, they take off and become a different team. Let's see how these rosters now shake out.
Any surprises in terms of what was the best team that positioned themselves for the playoffs by acquiring players?
I like what the Blue Jays did a lot. I don't necessarily think the Blue Jays are a World Series champion. You know, they could be. Anyone in the American League could really make a run, but they had to get a frontline pitcher, and they got the number one guy on the market, in my opinion. That was David Price. They get Troy Tulowitzki on the team as well, who will be with this team after this season. So it's a move for now, and David Price, Tulowitzki for the future. They definitely have the best offense in the American League, in my opinion, the best offense in all of baseball. Can they pitch enough? That's going to be questionable, but the strides they made on that team, I don't think anyone really rivals.
Okay, David Price, Troy Tulowitzki, the Jays now have the best true ace in the AL. But what about in terms of with depth with their pitching? Can you expound on that?
It's not good. I mean, it's going to have to be a situation like last year where if they get to the playoffs, they're going to have to run David Price out there quite a bit. You like the Giants did with Madison Bumgarner last year, essentially winning a World Series with one good pitcher in their rotation. And really, it's hard to imagine a team being able to do that and get through three postseason rounds. If there is a horse, though, in the American League, David Price is that guy. You hope Dallas Keuchel is that guy, too, for the Astros, for the people here in Houston. But Price, much more established, has done it for several years. Can he be the same guy in postseason play? That's going to be the question, because his postseason numbers aren't spectacular.
Okay, Andy Pondillo with us tonight in studio right here at YSR, the Big E Sports Show. Reach out to our audience where they can connect with you, Andy.
That's climbingtowshill.com. The podcast is Astrich.
Okay, so the Blue Jays, you don't buy them, or you do buy them as a postseason team, but not a World Series team. What about long-term in terms of the Jays' offense? Are they set for the future?
Yeah, they've got a spectacular offense. I feel like we've been talking about this for a long time with the Blue Jays. They've had a great offense. Even if you go back to the mid-2000s, there are times where they were top three in the league, and they still weren't making postseason play. The drought that has really hurt that team has usually been because of pitching. Do they have enough this year? I think so. The AL wild card, I think the second wild card slot, you could possibly get in this season with 86 wins. And really, that's not a great season at 86 wins, but it's enough to get you there. If you get into the postseason tournament, anything can happen. A lot of that, I think, could really shake out, too, if the Blue Jays get into this one-game playoff. Do they have to use David Price to get there? Do they have David Price available for a one-game playoff? Or can they catch the Yankees? In my opinion, the Yankees are still winning the American League East, though the Blue Jays now are going to push them a lot harder. The Yankees, to me, just more of a complete team. They have a shutdown bullpen. I mean, the Yankees have a lead after six innings. They're usually winning the game. The Blue Jays don't have that. They have to win games the hard way through bashing people's brains in offensively. It's worked to this point. It got them over 500. I don't like that model of baseball to get you through postseason play, though.
It's our MLB News and Notes with Andy Pondillo. He is giving an overview of all the deals. It was one of the busiest times of the year in baseball. And, of course, what about the Royals? I mean, they kind of get a high five for what they were able to accomplish.
Yeah, they gave up a lot of pitching in these deals, but, hey, Royals are in go-for-it mode. They have free agents that are looming. Alex Gordon going to be a free agent. They don't usually re-sign guys. They don't spend money like a high-market team does. So they feel like they've got to play for it this year. They've got to make those moves. Johnny Cueto coming in. Ben Zobrist coming in. I like the Cueto move a lot. It's a same deal with the Royals, but even better. If they have a lead, sometimes even after five innings with this team, they essentially can run four closers out, 6, 7, 8, 9, and end that game right there 2-1 if they need to. This team now has Johnny Cueto at the top of the rotation. You don't have to depend on to the bullpen quite as much when he's out there. You don't wear those guys down. They've pitched more innings than any other team in the American League. They're not getting innings out of their starters. But yet, their model has worked in 2015, where the bullpens are such a big deal. I feel like Johnny Cueto, though, gives him that true ace at the top. And last year, that was big game James Shields. I don't think he was really big game James Shields. They won other ways other than his arm. Now they have Cueto. Does he translate into being a big game pitcher in postseason play? That's yet to be known. And then Ben Zobrist, just an all-around great player. Guy can play any position. He probably slots in at second base once Alex Gordon comes back. Has a little pop, switch hitter. Gets on base. He fits really the Royals' dynamic for offense.
Do the Royals have fans? Should they have some anxiety? Because you're talking about they gave up a lot of pitching to win now and to have that win now mentality. How does this affect the Royals long term?
I don't think it affects them very favorable long term, but you know, they want to win. It's been a long time since this team's been able to win games, and with these moves, it does make them the favorite in the American League. They do have probably the most complete team. It does scare me that their relief pitchers have thrown so many innings to this point. I always talk about a domino effect, and sometimes that domino effect doesn't start to show itself till September once you get worn out arms. Let's see how they hang in there. Let's see how Cueto changes that. But with their experience of getting to the World Series last year, with the lead they have in the American League Central now, they could possibly get home field advantage throughout postseason play. You really feel like if you're looking at numbers, if you're looking at paper, that would be the team to pick in the American League. But sometimes I say that's who I would pick if I'm looking at it. But time and time again, the teams that make it to the World Series are the teams that nobody is picking, that nobody is on nobody's radar right now. That just seems how it works out so many times in baseball. So maybe it's a bad thing to be so good.
Ah, yes. The familiar voice of Andy Pondillo tonight at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. I'm Elissa Walker-Campbell. Connect with us online at Twitter, at eRadio Sports, and, you know, you're an optimistic guy. Talk to me, though, about the Reds. I mean, what in the world are they doing?
I don't know. They should have blown the whole team up. I don't understand why you trade one guy in Cueto. You trade Mike Leake to the Giants. Now, these guys, they got some return, but if they really wanted to rebuild, they wanted to rebuild fast. If they would have traded Todd Frazier this year, they would have been able to name what prospects they wanted and probably get two, three top five prospects from certain teams that want to win right now. The Reds, they've had some great years out of Todd Frazier these last two seasons.
Mm-hmm.
He's 29 years old. He's putting up these numbers that are, I think, could be an aberration. You've got to trade these guys high in baseball. It hurts the fan base. They're going to be upset. But, you know, if you're rebuilding a team, the quickest way to rebuild a team is to blow everything up that's good on the roster. You may lose for the next season. If you get some guys that are in double-A, that are in high triple-A, you might get back to competitiveness a lot quicker than you think. There's Brett Phillips on the team you could have tried to have moved. Jay Bruce, I mean, maybe not the easiest guys to move, but I'm sure they could get something for him. And Todd Frazier, Aroldis Chapman wasn't moved because they were asking for too much. Even with Chapman, for instance, he's a free agent next year. Even if you would have gotten lower value than you wanted, you have to get something for Aroldis Chapman. You can't just not get anything for him and leave him on your roster. So the Reds really dropped the ball this trade season.
You know, Andy, this was a win-win trade. Talk about the Brewers. They got a great haul from the Astros in return for center fielder Carlos Gomez.
I think it's a win trade for both, definitely. The Astros needed another bat on this team, especially with George Springer's injury. And Carlos Gomez really fits the dynamic for the Astros. Their speed and power, and he's a speed and power guy. He's had some hip problems this year. We'll see how that plays out. They have him for next season. The Astros give up top prospects Brett Phillips, Domingo Santana in this deal too. Outfielders that project very highly. Again, they're prospects you don't really know. Fortunately for the Astros, they had a very successful 2015 draft that included multiple outfield candidates. You got Daz Cameron, Kyle Tucker in that draft, and Alex Bregman, who was their number two overall pick in the draft. First pick for the Astros, number two overall in the draft. He's a shortstop, but I wouldn't be surprised if he starts to play outfield at some time because of Carlos Correa. So they're okay in the outfield. They could afford to have given these guys up. If they succeed in Milwaukee, it hurts. Carlos Gomez right now makes the Astros, I would say, the second most dangerous team in the American League under the Kansas City Royals.
And Andy, let's head up to Arlington. Talk to me about the Rangers acquiring the acquisition of Cole Hamels. That is a huge move.
Cole Hamels is huge for the Rangers. You match him with Yu Darvish. That's going to be dynamic 1-2, possibly for them. I really think this move is more for next season, though. The Rangers, I think, can stay in the hunt, mainly because of a weak American League. And, you know, they're still in that AL West hunt. They've been hot lately. I think they're more of a wild card contender to try and get to that second wild card. I don't believe in them as much because in 2015, if you have a weak bullpen, it's just hard to win the way bullpens are used these days. And they have the worst bullpen in all of baseball. Though they have a good offense, it's been improving. Prince Fielder is having a very solid season. Adrian Beltre now swinging a bat like he looks like he's healthy. So, you know, the Rangers aren't out of it. I don't believe in them, but other people do. I think next year, though, once you get you back from his surgery, you put Cole at the top of that rotation. How does he handle the heat in Arlington is questionable for a 30-plus-year-old pitcher. But if they pitch like they normally do, they put up their normal numbers, those two alone put them atop the AL West. They should be able to compete with the Angels and Astros a little bit easier next season.
Well, the arrival of Cole Hamels has certainly energized the Rangers fan base. And I know earlier this spring we had Josh Hamilton was on the show. What kind of impact do you think you're seeing with him with the Rangers?
Not much at all. It's sad to watch Josh Hamilton now play like a shell of his old self. He doesn't get to balls in the outfield anymore. His power is limited. I don't know. Maybe he turns it up towards the end of the year. It's just he doesn't look like the same player. Everything just looks a bit slower with the bat. The reaction's slower. The pitch selection's not as good. I don't know. Is he done? I don't want to say that because we've been fooled in the past where some of these players come back and have a big season. It just doesn't look like the same player to me.
Well, it'd be nice if they can get back on track on those old days. Darvish and Hamels, that'll be obviously a 1-2 punch. That'll be huge. I think one of the great stories this year in baseball has been the Mets. Talk to us about them.
The Mets have been fun. They have unlimited pitching, really. The pitching for this team is just through the roof. They should be a contender for a very long time. Now, they go and get Yonas Cespedes to that lineup. I don't really believe in this lineup still. Lucas Duda is a guy that can hit for some power. David Wright, if they ever can keep him in the lineup for a considerable amount of time, that surely could help the team. I don't know. The Mets, just this whole NL East is kind of sketchy, though. They're on the right track. If this season is a wild card year and they're out in a wild card game or they make it to postseason play and are out in the division series, it's a success, in my opinion, because this organization has been mediocre for a long time, but they have developed an incredible pitching staff what they're running out there, and I think it will be unrivaled next year with the entire National League East. They just got to find a way to fix that offensive situation. So I like the Mets. I don't know if they win this division or not, but I think they can take it till September.
So you're saying, when I'm hearing you say this pitching, I mean, they've got so much depth that that's the reason why they should be able to contend for a long time?
Yeah, starting pitching is going to keep them in contention, is pretty much solely in contention. I think if you were to look at their roster this season, if they don't have that type of starting pitching, there's no way they're even close to in the hunt right now. This unit with Wheeler, Harvey, I mean, these guys, DeGrom, they're going to be at this team for a long time, most likely, unless they decide to trade one for a bat. But even if they do, let's say they trade Wheeler for a bat. I mean, they still got a really good pitching staff. Mm-hmm. They have so many guys that they can't even put a five-man rotation together. They had to run six out earlier this season. So it should be a lot of fun up in New York for those Mets fans.
Okay, my final question for you is, obviously it's a stretch run. We're getting ready to close out the season. It'll be coming to an end before we know it. What team do you really see surfacing and rising to the top?
I like the Pirates a lot right now. They've got some good mojo going their way. Can they catch the Cardinals? That's going to be interesting. That NL Central race is going to be one of the better races, I think. You could possibly see the two top teams in the National League coming from the NL Central and another, you know, the one that doesn't win that seed. They have to play into a one-game wild card. And also in the NL West, the Giants coming down the stretch. It's an odd season. They usually win in even seasons. But, boy, I don't want to face the Giants coming down the stretch with Madison Bumgarner. So watching them in the West, with the Giants, the Dodgers, Cardinals, Pirates, I really want to watch how these two rivalries play out.
It's an exciting time of year. Andy Pondillo with us each and every week right here at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Thanks so much, Andy. Have a great weekend.
No problem.
Okay, much more straight ahead tonight at YSR. Elissa Walker-Campbell, welcome back to Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. As a reminder, listen to the show on the go. Just download the Yahoo Sports Radio app by searching Yahoo Sports Radio in your app store. You can listen on any computer or smart device by going to streamysr.com. Well, in our final segment tonight, we are getting ready to completely shift gears. We're going to preview the 2015 Hamiltonian, the biggest harness race of the year, live from the Meadowlands. Coverage begins at 4 o'clock Eastern Time on the CBS Sports Network. And it's so wonderful to have with us on our Progressive Insurance Celebrity Guest Line, Sam McKee. He is a veteran commentator of horse racing. He will call the Hamiltonian, and it's time now to go into the harness racing zone, the countdown to the 90th anniversary of the Hamiltonian. Good evening, Sam. It's the first time on the show.
Well, good evening, Alyssa. Thank you so much for having me, and can't wait to talk Hamiltonian. I have a great passion for the sport of harness racing, as many people do, and this is our Kentucky Derby, and we are looking forward to a huge day at the Meadowlands.
Well, the big race is set. It's time to pull back the curtain, and I want you to share for our listeners who is in contention and the favorite leading up to this prestigious race.
There's actually two favorites, and ironically, Alyssa, it's kind of like a Jimmy Connors, Chris Everett, or Billie Jean King sort of thing, because one of them is a filly. The colt is named Pinkman, and he's a very consistent colt. In fact, he's probably going to be the morning line favorite over the whole thing. But Mission Brief, the filly, is the fastest two-year-old ever in the sport. Her connections are facing the boys here, and that adds a lot of drama to the race.
You know, I find this so fascinating. I don't know a lot about the sport, but provide some background for our listeners on the Trotting Triple Crown. I mean, what's the difference between thoroughbred racing, in which we think of, you know, what comes to my mind is Secretariat or American Pharoah, and this weekend's Hamiltonian at the Meadowlands?
Well, basically, they're two different breeds. The thoroughbreds have jockeys on their back, and they gallop at full speed when they race, whereas the standardbreds pace or trot. That's their gates that they race at, and they're a different breed themselves. So our trotters and pacers go about 35 to 37 miles per hour. Thoroughbreds can run a mile around. A real good horse, maybe 136, 137, and our world record in harness racing is about 146, 147. So they're pretty similar in speed, just a little bit slower. But we have drivers that drive the horses sitting in what we call sulkies, which are two-wheeled vehicles that are hitched to the horse's back, mm-hmm. kind of like carriage horses or that sort of thing, except they're very, very aerodynamic and very sleek designed, and these horses are bred to race. So those are the biggest differences there. But if you like horse racing, good horse racing is good horse racing. The Hamiltonian's as good as it gets.
Well, Sam, you're a veteran commentator of horse racing. What do you love about the sport the most?
I grew up with horses, and my family actually raced harness horses, at the county fairs in Michigan, and I used to drive a little bit when I was younger, and that's how I fell in love with the game. But I've worked at thoroughbred tracks, too, and that's very enjoyable, too. I enjoy both both breeds, the thoroughbreds and the standardbreds. But for me, it's the horses, and every horse is different. They have their own characteristics and their own running styles and racing styles. And just to watch the races unfold and pace and position and everything else, I really get into the racing itself.
Okay, the countdown to the 90th anniversary of the Hamiltonian. And if I'm correct, the Hamiltonian is considered the most elite horse harness race in the world and regularly draws, what, around 25,000 fans to the Meadowlands. Talk about why it's such a big deal, because it is a special race.
For us, it's kind of like the Daytona 500 or the Super Bowl for our sport. And it's not just the Hamiltonian itself. I mean, the race is fantastic, but it's all the hoopla that surrounds the race as well. We have so much going on at the Meadowlands every Hamiltonian day. We turn it into a carnival for kids with all kinds of games and rides and pony rides and that sort of thing. Always have some great bands and great food. And this year we have a harness racing fan zone in the morning where fans can actually meet and greet the top drivers and trainers in the sport. And we've got photo opportunities with them and social media tweets and everything like that. It's going to be a lot of fun out here at the Meadowlands. And people can really connect with harness racing as well. Our horses are a lot calmer, and the people have more access to the horses and the drivers and the trainers, and it's a sport that kind of captures the imagination of rural America, and we've run it to the big city here at the Meadowlands just across the bridge from Manhattan.
Okay, it'll all get underway on Saturday. The race airs on the CBS Sports Network Saturday afternoon. And one more quick hit. Does it get the worldwide attention and the feedback from the fans, like, say, the Kentucky Derby or the Belmont?
It does, maybe not as much in North America, but we have huge coverage overseas. There's like 18 different countries overseas that are carrying the races. France is very big. Sweden is really into the trotting game, and they're taking most of our races. Finland, Denmark, Norway, Germany, even Australia and New Zealand, harness racing is very popular there, and there is a tremendous amount of interest in the racing for the Meadowlands on Saturday, and the supporting card is fantastic. It's kind of like an all-star game every single race with the best horses in every category, and with 16 races we start at noon, we'll wrap up probably about 6:45 at night, and everybody will get their money's worth, that's for sure.
Okay, Sam McKee, veteran commentator of sports racing, getting you ready for the 2015 Hamiltonian, the biggest harness race of the year, live from Meadowlands on Saturday. You can watch it on CBS Sports at 4 o'clock Eastern Time. Thank you so much, Sam. We appreciate you joining us tonight at YSR.
Thank you, Alyssa. We'll get you out here and have you jog a racehorse one day, and you'll get up close and personal with the sport.
That, of course, was Sam McKee, veteran commentator of horse riding. We want to take time to thank all of our amazing guests, our lineup. Each and every week, Andy Pondillo with our MLB news and notes. Monty Burke, the author of Nick Saban, the new book, The Making of a Coach. Brandon Wright of the Memphis Grizzlies. And Dennis Franchione, head coach at Texas State. I'm Alyssa Walker-Campbell, encouraging you not to drink and drive. We'll see you next weekend for the biggest, the best in sports, the Big E Sports Show. And a very special thank you to our producer, Joe George.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of U.S. soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.